Blog Talk Radio.
Representing the very sun itself, the great sun of the morning.
In fact, I'll read the verse again. How art thou fallen from heaven, Lucifer, O son of the morning, morning star? How art thou cut to the ground, which didst weaken the nations? Isaiah 14:12. The word Lucifer is commonly used. Just about everyone in the world has heard this word who speaks English, and as well is used in Scripture. Today we will discuss some aspects of the history of the devil. Which one is the truth? Slanderer, accuser, or misunderstood hero, bringer of light? Is there another character altogether, not attached to the name Lucifer? We will try to cut through some of this confusion today on Main Street Universe. and welcome to Main Street Universe. This is Wednesday. This is our flagship show. And I see we're joined in the chat room by Kevin Baird, the old co-founder and co-host on our Wednesday at 11 a.m. show. And soon he'll be changing the time and day of his show, as yet to be announced in the future. Not exactly sure what day, but it's going to be coming soon. And according to my talks with him, it should be a morning show or early in the day sometime. I'm in-house today. I'm not out in the studio. Nick Berry may be joining us here at some time. And today's topic is the history of the devil. And I'd like to get out there right out front that when I discuss these things, I'm doing it from a scholarly position. I do not in any way intend to offend Christians or Satanists or Luciferians or anyone out there of any religious leaning. We're simply discussing the idea of a devil, the adversary, and as well as some misinterpretations. I guess another thing to say, since some people know that I'm pagan, and that witchcraft is part of my religion, that no, I do not myself worship a devil or the devil. In fact, the entire pantheon is different than that. We'll get to those things later. Try not to make the show too much about me. Just wanted to get a couple disclaimers out there early. And I welcome everyone, as well as welcome everyone in the future as I travel through time to speak into the future, because we get a lot of archive listens here on Blog Talk Radio. We had some great listens for our show we did with Reverend Donald Robinson, who runs a great nonprofit charity called Beacon House. And they've done a lot of great work, and he's built himself up to such a successful point that they have a championship football team that competes with other schools. And this is just as a little nonprofit that tutors kids. There's all sorts of classes, great programs. So check them out at www.beaconhouse.org. It's in Washington, D.C. And at some point, my brother and I might be doing an on-location show at Beacon House. And I hope everyone had a pleasant Thanksgiving. I had an amazing Thanksgiving. I was up in Connecticut. So Thanksgiving in New England, I was running around with my digital recorder to all the little stops we made, as well as in-house. I was at my in-law's house, the married into side of the family, and there was a lot of great college students, you know, young people, still in that early 20s stage of their life and all kinds of big dreams. And they're students at the drama department of Yale, and I got to get some of them into the act as well. Interviewed a few of them, and we made some noise, as there was about 25 or so, I think, if I count correctly, at the dinner. It was a big old table, lots of people, lots of camaraderie, young, old, middle-aged alike. It was a lot of fun. And great food. Local bird. A lot of the food was grown outside in the garden, as well as some other dishes that were made. There was a really good spiced cranberry thing that my brother's wife made. And it was an all-around good time, and I hope that all of you had an enjoyable Thanksgiving as well. I'd like to remind everybody that Main Street Universe is not just a show, but it's a network of shows. Again, I mentioned Kevin Baird. His show, Walking on the Sidewalk, is going to be getting a little reconstruction going on, so he'll be switching days. but can still be heard in the archives and should be starting up again soon. Thursdays we have Zariana Radio, which might be changing soon, folks. Evan Pass is moving back to India. And I don't think he's going to try to keep the show up from India. But maybe call in from time to time as a guest. There's still some time before this happens, about, I think, a month. We'll make an official announcement about it and a farewell episode when it happens. But as far as now, he'll be in tomorrow doing his Thursday show. Zariana Radio, a show all about the importance of myth in war, kind of a Joseph Campbell of our network. And then Fridays at midnight, we have Jesse Ann Nichols George activating compassion in the midnight hour. And Jesse's doing a great job there, full of advice, and she's had some other, her own charities and nonprofit groups, some animal rescue folks there. And a lot of it is about, just as it says, activating compassion. And she has a book, two books, Activating Compassion and the Activating Compassion Workbook, of which she gave me two copies here, or a copy of each here, as she was on her book tour and stopped by. So Fridays at midnight, Jesse Ann Nichols George, Activating Compassion in the Midnight Hour. I'll take a brief sip of my peppermint tea, and we will get back to our topic, the history of the devil. Let us take a look at when the devil appears in the biblical texts. Not going as yet far back as the book of Enoch, but let's start with texts that a lot of people know from the Bible itself. The book of Job. In the book of Job, one of God's angels, in Hebrew it's Ha-Satan, or the prosecutor, is given the unique task of going and tempting humans and then reporting back to God to state who remained faithful and who did not. God was particularly fond of one person, Job. Job was righteous and he was loyal. In the book of Job, 1:9, and relating verses nearby, Ha-Satan, again one of God's angels, begins to question Job's loyalty. Ha-Satan makes the point that Job is loyal and righteous simply because he possesses all that an earthly man could desire. Wealth, livestock, a large family, safety. In short, God and Ha-Satan make a bet. Ha-Satan, the prosecutor, is allowed to take away the good life that Job has come to know, bringing him disease, misery, loss. Job stays loyal to God. Job passes the test, much to the surprise of Ha-Satan. So Ha-Satan returns to heaven to sit in the divine council of angels again. This is not the only time when tragic and vicious things are brought down upon humanity or upon a person or humans by angels under the order of God. Let us look at Exodus, when God commands a destroyer to kill all of the firstborn children in Egypt whose house does not have a mark of lamb's blood on the doors. Exodus 12:22 states, "When the Lord goes through the land to strike down the Egyptians, You will see the blood on the top sides of the door frame. It will pass over the doorway, and he will not permit the destroyer to enter your houses and strike you down. Again, that was Exodus 12:22. It is important again to note that this destroyer is commanded by God. It's one of his archangels. Malak Hamaset, shortened sometimes to Maset, is the smiting angel, the destructor, destroyer, prosecutor. Basically, this is an angel that's kind of, hey, you need somebody to do the dirty work. Another word for the angel of punishment or destruction is Satan, or the Hebrew Ha-Satan. It is more of a descriptive term at this point in biblical history. It is not necessarily describing an all evil being. A Satan was an adversary, a prosecutor, a destroyer, many different adjectives actually. But remember, under the command of God. Again, a descriptive term more than an all evil being in the Old Testament. In 1 Samuel 29:4, David, the father of Solomon, is not trusted. In 1 Samuel 29:4, it says, quote, "He must not go with us into battle, or he will become a Satan during the fighting, a Satan during the fighting." Psalms 109:6, another mention of a Satan as just sort of a descriptive. Now, these change as later versions of the Bible come about. And some go back more to their old characteristics. There's a lot of Bibles out there, folks, and there's a lot of them to look up. But there are commonalities that are descriptive. This one from Psalm 109:6. "Appoint someone evil to oppose my enemy. Let a Satan stand at his right hand." Again, it's sort of talking about it in a descriptive. The idea of a Satan, a Ha-Satan, or a Satan is not an ultimate evil being, ultimate evil incarnate. This idea, in fact, doesn't necessarily even begin to reveal itself in early Christianity, in the Old Testament. So let's take a breath. We've covered what a Satan is, some of its etymological history, and the fact that in the Old Testament it doesn't necessarily refer to an ultimate evil being. This is going to have people wondering, well, isn't there bad stuff out there? Bad forces? Well, I say, of course there is. But we're talking about the need to personify it into one mass evil and where that can take us. So as we take a breath, and I sip this amazing peppermint tea, which is really nice, let's bring this down to earth a minute. Let's examine early Christianity like this. In a way, an argument could be made that early Christian writings have left over polytheistic traits, meaning traits of religions, the old religions that had many, many gods. The many archangels, or gods, quote unquote, are all commanded by one king god, each angel, with its own speciality. I will quote another early Bible verse here, Genesis 1:26. "Then God said, 'Let us make mankind in our image, in our likeness. He's referring to not just one. One of the very first books in the Bible starts talking about there's more people involved, or more gods involved. This argument has also been used in alien astronaut theory. I'm not going to dig at all into alien astronaut theory today. I'm just saying that Genesis 1:26 has been used for that argument of us originating from another planet, looking upon their creation or synthetic creation. Sometimes synthetic creativity is referred to as creating from something that's already there. And the alien astronaut theorists believe they took some of their own genetics, mixed it with the genetics of whatever beings were here, and bam, you got human beings. We're not going to go into that any further today. But I will say that outside of that, there is an argument of leftover poly or many god, polytheistic religious traits right in one of the first books of the Bible, Genesis. Genesis 1:26. Then God said, let us make mankind in our image, in our likeness. So, brief review. We discussed Exodus. We discussed the sending down of an archangel, Hashatan, to do the dirty work that is sometimes necessary when folks aren't obeying for whatever reason that the pantheon has set up. In the First Testament of the Bible, and early on, it mentions things like saying things like us. There are other references to not just God sort of talking to himself, but saying things like us. And then that takes us to the other Old Testament argument, that there isn't really a mention in the Old Testament, in the time when, honestly, is a little harsher, the time where punishments are, you know, coming down on people, the plagues and all of this, there's no mention of a great almighty evil being, this great adversary. There's mentions of what an adversary is and what an angel of prosecution is sent down by the Lord himself. And Kevin says in the chat room, group of divine God. Yes, and so no mention in the First Testament of a divine evil being. There's serpents, there's Hashatan, there's different adversaries, but no real mention of a great ultimate evil from which we are at war with constantly. And I'm going to do a very brief song here. Hello, Veronica. I see Veronica's in. I'm going to do a very brief song, and then I'm going to come right back and continue our discussion. This one is Nights Over Baghdad. friend Tom Teasley, Nights Over Baghdad. Going to have him on the show soon as a guest. Just got to work out those schedules, especially around this time of the year. Also like to make an announcement that author Christopher Penzack is going to be our guest Wednesday, January 9th. So be an honor to have Chris Penzack on the show. I'm a fan of his books. And I do use the techniques and have historically similar techniques to the ones he has in his book called The Inner Temple. So I'm kind of looking forward to talking to Chris Penzack on the show. And anyway, for those of you just joining us, we were discussing some brief biblical history of the devil. And where does he first show up? Started off right off the bat with Isaiah 14:12, which mentions, "How art thou fallen from heaven, Lucifer, O son of the morning, morning star? How art thou cut to the ground, which didst weaken nations?" We discussed further back in the Old Testament, Genesis 1:26, of the leftover polytheistic things in the Bible. Then God said, "Let us make mankind in our own image, in our own likeness." Now let's move on to a little bit of pre-biblical history, before the Bible mentions Hasatan or the prosecutors or destroyers sent out in Exodus 12:22 and other places. Let's take a look at the earlier religions. We'll start about 3,000 years ago with Zoroaster. Now, Zoroaster is a very interesting character. Zoroaster lived in a time when the old pagan religions had many, many gods, sort of like a god for every little thing there was. You know, god of water, fire, god of, you know, jealousy, whatever. Something had a god or goddess for it. Zoroaster decided to simplify this argument. He took sort of the qualities from all the bad, or as he saw the bad gods, and made it into one single entity, one lord of chaos, darkness, and lies. He referred to this new dark entity as Ahriman. Ahriman representing all of the bad qualities. So, of course, he then took all of what he saw were the good deities and the good qualities they had, combined them all into one good god, and referred to this deity as Ahura Mazda, light, order. Adding, now that he has his, well, he's got good over here, and, well, gosh, he's got bad over here, comes to the conclusion that the universe is a battlefield. And upon death, the good go to paradise, and the bad go to a dark, terrible place. The Zoroastrian ideas then took hold under Emperor Darius the Great. And these ideas begin to find themselves in early Jewish scripture. Now, Alexander comes in, Alexander the Great, and Alexander defeats the Iranians. The Iranians later come to be called the Persians. Some people think it was Persia first and then Iran. It was Iran first, and then it was Persia. The Greeks called them Persia. And then they returned, I believe, in 1948 to call themselves Iran again. So, Zoroaster creates a major battling duality religion of one good god, one bad god. To simplify it, you know, for or against, which one is it? Nice and simple. Not a whole bunch of gods for everything out there in the cosmos. Darius the Great, the emperor, a very powerful emperor of Iran at that time, embraces these ideals. So then conquered by Alexander the Great of Greece. Alexander brings his Greek pantheon with him. Part of that, that many of you out there in our listening audience may know, includes Hades. Now, Hades in Greek is not necessarily a hell. It's just sort of a dim place that you may go to after you die. And Hades can sort of decide whether or not this experience is going to be pleasurable or not. But this wasn't an all-out damnation. It was just, well, you know, if Hades approves of you, this will be a more pleasant stay kind of a thing. But it does start to create the image of a place that could be bad to go when you die, and do so in a very sort of official way, I guess, in a way that the empire supports. But still, no ultimate evil being. Bad forces in the universe, yes. Bad gods, yes. Ahriman from the conquered Iranian Empire, then called Persia later by the Greeks, yes. But in the Greek pantheon, there wasn't necessarily this equivalent of Ahriman. So now we've gotten into Hades and the beginnings, potential beginnings, of the really bad place to go for eternity when you die. And that takes us to Gehenna. Gehenna is a place where basically rubbish was burned. They said it smelled horrible, and it was a place where the bodies of criminals who'd been executed would be sent to burn in the trash heap, considered just a miserable fate. Who would want, instead of having a nice burial or cremation or whatever your custom is at the time, who would want to be burned in Gehenna dishonorably upon death? It is this place, Gehenna, Kevin and I had talked about this on another show. There was another place that was sort of a work, underground work place you were punished to go to, too. All this combined with Hades, Gehenna, started to influence, okay, in early Christian writings started to think, well, okay, let's use this as an inspiration for hell, as a representation of what happens if you don't find yourself coming to enlightenment. Later on, much later on, the Roman Empire comes about, and under Emperor Nero, Satan is seen, the devil is seen as the power behind the Roman Empire. Like, how could they have done this? They must be operating under a supernatural force. They must have a powerful Ha-Satan behind them, motivating this. So, this is when the famous 666 comes about. The beast, 666. Now, where does this number come from? People have said there's an antichrist that's going to come about in our modern times. And you'll know because they'll bear the mark of the beast, 666. Well, 666 is the numeric, numerological equivalent of Nero, Emperor Nero, known to be kind of a cruel emperor, Nero Caesar in Aramaic, the old language of Aramaic. His name matches up numerologically to 666. The beast, 666, is not Aleister Crowley. It is not a future antichrist that's going to be put upon us. The beast, 666, is from thousands of years ago, and it's Emperor Nero Caesar. Now, let's jump further, even a little more in history, after we've established, okay, Zoroaster had good and evil gods. Greeks come in. Okay, they get rid of that, and they have their multi-god pantheons, the one we're used to, Zeus and the whole nine yards. They bring in Hades. This, okay, starts to begin the idea of a place that's not too pleasant to go to when you die. Gehenna. All these places come along, the trash heaps of Gehenna that are burned in a terrible-smelling, foul place where you don't want to be thrown to after you die as a criminal. Now let's jump a little further ahead into Europe and take a look at, okay, now there's imagery needed for those that you wish to convert. Not necessarily always conquer, but convert. So how do we get, you know, the Christian God, the new religion, to come in and kind of, you know, a little fear can always help. So what are we going to make the devil look like? Oftentimes it's dark-skinned, taloned feet, or the cloven hooves. The devil can change into a serpent. A lot of these features come from the old pagan gods. So they're saying, you know what? You could be, you know, you could be worshiping. You could be on the wrong team here. So then, as I said in the show's marquee, why the horns? Well, the horns represent the hunt, the hunter, the creatures often being hunted, strength, masculinity. So why not take those symbols of the old horned gods, often powerful male gods, or sometimes very, like in the case of Pan. Pan was a demonized horned god who was popular and who was just the god of happiness, of sex, and of music, and of pleasure. But either way, whether it represented happiness, music, sex, pleasure, or strength in the hunt, they took the horns and they put it onto a new Christian Ha-Satan, prosecutor, destroyer, adversary, and the image of the devil comes about. As I said before, in the Old Testament, there's not even a mention of an all-evil being, or if there is, I haven't found it, and I'm not someone who is saying, as I said before, that evil forces don't exist. What I'm saying is that the being, the ultimate evil being of Satan, the devil, comes about later on. And the word, even the word, Satan or Ha-Satan or just Satan, was used more as a descriptive in the old texts. So, now let's jump forward a little bit in history. The Inquisition is created in 1227. Okay, now I know some of you are thinking, wait a minute, the Spanish Inquisition was much later than that. Yes, it was. Late 1400s, early 1500s. But there was another Inquisition in place. Pope Gregory the Ninth had founded this. Now, one thing interesting about the Inquisition and about their activities is that they mostly went after other Christians. And within their own ranks start to develop a lot of myth of their own. Some pretty fascinating stuff, really. Here's a great example. Some very loyal Christians. The Gnostics and the Cathars. Now, the Gnostics and Cathars kind of had a few things in common. I'm going to focus on the Cathars, though. The Cathars believed that everything in this physical world was evil. However, the Cathars were certainly not inquisitors. The Cathars was very giving and kind. They were very extreme in their viewpoint, but they helped the poor. They healed when they could. Again, giving food and aid to poor and to the sick. They gave of themselves. And they believed that no human should procreate. So their reason, which I always found interesting, for not procreating is so that we don't have to be born here, because they view the earth as the ultimate, you know, bad experience. Again, not really that much of a mention of a hellfire, all that. They're just saying, well, if we're not born, if we stop having babies, we just get to live spiritual lives, and we don't have to get into the mud and the dirt and all the, you know, stuff that comes with being human. The Cathars become an enemy of the church. Now, someone might be saying, why would these, though fairly extreme, Christians be an enemy of the main church? Why would be an enemy of the Inquisition? Well, the reason is because they weren't providing that great adversary. Basically, they're prosecuted for just believing in Christianity in a slightly different way than does the main church at the time that was dominating. So you could make the argument that the Cathars were prosecuted and sought out and punished by the Inquisition for being too Christian and for just giving of themselves. So that takes me to St. Augustine, who points out, and this takes us in another direction that's pretty interesting, we're getting into the blame game. Again, the Cathars weren't blaming too much except for just the physical world. The Inquisition saw them as bad. Let's get and move this thing forward and get back to the devil and such. St. Augustine points out that the old natural gods are demons. St. Augustine actually blames sexual urges on visits from demons. Incubi, a male demon, or succubi, female demon. Some of you may be familiar with the band Incubus Succubus. And that's what it means. They're beings of sexual temptation, according to your interpretation. So this begins to fuel all these fires and the founding of this Inquisition. A little later in history, we begin to have, in 1307, King Philip the Fair. Here comes a witchcraft charge, and in another unlikely place. First we have the Cathars not being the right type of Christian. Now we have the Knights Templar, the Crusaders themselves, spreading Christianity, taking on the Islamic empires, and negotiating with them from time to time too. The Templars are accused of worshiping an idol or a god known as Baphomet. We'll get to Baphomet later. On Friday the 13th, 1307, the very knights who gathered a fortune and fought the Crusades for the Christian Empire had all of their strongholds attacked by Philippe the Fair, ruler of France at the time. The Templar strongholds were attacked, and they were defeated. They were purged, basically. So that takes us a little further into history now, to 1320. Pope John the 22nd orders the Inquisition to go after any. Now they're upping the stakes a little bit here. They're getting a little more specific. Any witchcraft, sorcery, necromancy, any of it. They begin to develop formulas to command demons. So think of this now. Now we're talking about Christians ordering demons about. So a fear came, said, wait a minute, if we develop a formula to command the demons, what if one of these evil sorcerers, necromancers, or witches get a hold of it? They'll be able to command demons. They were also afraid that from within, that the church monks involved in these Inquisition trials, these formulas, could start to use this themselves and become powerful sort of wizards themselves. So this became a worry. So again, okay, we need a structure here. This is all getting crazy. This brings me to the next part of my show. Malleus Maleficarum, the hammer of the witches. The Malleus Maleficarum is produced by two German monks, German Dominican monks. This becomes sort of a guidebook to help calm the fears of the Inquisition clergy, to say, okay, here we go. Here's how we can tell. This is going to tell us, here's the test, here's to say, okay, you're a witch, you're not. So it claims witchcraft is heresy. The other trick to this hammer of the witches is that not believing in witchcraft is heresy as well. And here are some of the things Malleus Maleficarum mentions in its guide. The witches can or have a birthmark. They use flying herbs and fly through the air. They gather in Sabbaths. In one Sabbath, there's a mentioning of them kissing the devil's buttocks. Now, about 30 years after the Malleus Maleficarum is created, the church is split into two groups. Now you have Catholic and Protestant. As the witch hunts progress, they become almost sort of a scientific inquiry. So capturing these people, they start asking them a lot of questions. This is where some more controversy comes in, and torture becomes more common. Pope Gregory IX, when he first started this original Inquisition, for whatever you may or may not agree with him, he was very much against torture and made it public that he was very much against torture. And for a good while, it was illegal to torture Christians. Now, Muslims and people of other faiths, okay, that was okay to torture them. But it was still illegal to torture Christians for a while when the Inquisition first got its start. Of course, that changed over time as they wanted to get more and more information. And just as sometimes in modern-day times, they forget that sometimes information received in torture is not always accurate. They're pretty much just trying to stop the pain. So you now have the hammer of the witches, the Malleus Maleficarum. You have the Spanish Inquisition and all those things that become part of sort of common history. You have the Crusades that just preceded that. And there's this idea of there's God against an ultimate evil devil out there. And this just becomes common in the minds and in the hearts of the people, or especially for the people for whom it benefited. In the actual Bible itself are not a whole lot of, there are some, but are not a whole lot of references to this big, grand, good and evil battle. And they pretty much don't even show up in the First Testament. Again, as a review, in the First Testament, Hebrew words such as Hasatan come to be known as Satan or Satan. There's the word Lucifer, which means light bearer or light bringer, and doesn't seem to be representing anything ultimately evil at all. There is as well the destroyers and prosecutor angels that are part of the archangel pantheon that are under the orders of God. So it is humans that begin over time to create through their power structures. They begin to create this idea, this ideal of ultimate good, ultimate bad, starting with Zoroaster. Then the idea of hell comes about through Hades, Gehenna, and other punishment places, real on the earth. Gehenna was a real place where trash heaps were burned. So as a review, for those of you joining us, or that will in the future, early on, almost no mention of ultimate divine evil powerful being or ultimate good versus evil cosmic warfare. It is seen more as a natural progression early on. And again, even the word Satan or Satan or Hasatan, from the Hebrew Hasatan, is basically a descriptive word of a type of adversary, not an ultimate evil, dark father of chaos and lies. Again, there's bad stuff out there, but not exactly this us and them, for and against, one-stop, you know, one-stop shopping kind of a religion. You could almost say that the early Christians were slightly more liberated before all of this use of, as often happens with religion, people can twist it for their own purposes. With that statement, that takes us to almost how we are in the modern day. There's a lot of people out there now with an us and them mentality. There's lots of great quotes from liberating older Christians. One I can think of is William Wilberforce, who is someone who's in England, tried to end the slave trade and had a degree of success, I believe. And he mentioned seeing God in nature. And he was a devout Christian, or claimed to be. He mentioned seeing God in a spider web and saying, there must be a God. Look at this amazing thing. Look at this spider web. So it wasn't always, and different factions of Christianity aren't so harsh and aren't so just us and again, us and them, for or against, I meant to say. And on that note, we'll take a break. It takes us to where we are now, is what has developed over time in history is an us against them philosophy, including in the modern wars, including in modern leadership. Not a political show, but I think some of us know a few leaders I might be talking about. And including in some of the laws going on today, like in Africa, they're proposing a new execution for all homosexuals law in Uganda and referring to it as a Christmas gift. Maybe the devil really does exist, but not in the horned being that we're speaking of today. But we'll come back to that. When we come back to that, we'll talk about images of the devil, including Baphomet, including the ideas of light and dark, and including how the words used for the devil have evolved. We'll be back after a brief song. And this one is Sixth Son. All right, everyone, and we're back after a little break. And that brings us up to the next portion of the topic I'd like to get into, and that is of various images of what the devil is, and some of the etymological things as well. I mentioned earlier Baphomet, being that the Knights Templar were accused by Philip the Fair, the ruler of France at the time, of worshipping. Now, some of you may be asking, what is Baphomet? And I will tell you. Baphomet is the figure that's often seen and does look very devilish by Christian standards. He's portrayed the image that can look very frightening if you are raised Christian. And I'll describe the classical Baphomet. By that I mean the image that's most well known by Eliphas Levi. It's a human's body in a somewhat seated position. The body appears to be part male and part female. The legs are that of an animal with cloven hooves, cloven feet. The head is a large head of a goat. The goat's head has a pentacle on the forehead. It's similar and has a similar depiction in the Rider-Waite Tarot somebody mentioned in the chat room earlier. It has human arms. In the human arms of the Baphomet, one arm points up, the other arm points down. So, okay, if you've seen this image before, the one in the Rider-Waite's a little different. I'm talking about the classic Baphomet in Eliphas Levi's work. It became a very famous picture and is often associated with devil worship and Satanism, the big goat's head. Let's take a look at the symbol, though, closely and see what we make of it. Because even the modern Satanists themselves claim this image. Let's look at the one I just described. Okay, there's one hand pointing up, one hand pointing down. As above, so below. In the image of Baphomet, the elements are as well represented. Above the head of this goat, in the classical image that I'm referring to, the one from Eliphas Levi, there is a flame. It's a torch with a little flame on it. This represents intelligence, ideas, action. This is fire. The Baphomet also has wings, for those of you familiar with the classical image. His wings represent air. There's a calm sea in the background. This represents water and intuitive wisdom. There's a pentacle on his forehead. And he as well has animal parts. This is representative of earth. Two moons are present in the symbol. He's pointing up towards the lighter moon and down towards the darker moon. There are people out there that will say that this means good moon, bad moon, that he's pointing to good and evil. And of course, they are entitled to that opinion, and it is in part perhaps true. Here's what I think the two different moons mean, especially because they're facing two different directions. I think that the Baphomet image is pointing to one and then the next one coming around below to mention the continuation of moon cycles. I even think that this is perhaps a clue to reincarnation, meaning that you may do this and that, that you may believe this and that and take what actions you're going to take, but the cycle will continue. the phases of the moon will continue their natural progression, their natural cycles. As above, so below. As the universe, so the soul. You as well continue. You are part of all of this. And I will acknowledge that, yes, polarities are represented as well. So that is how I interpret the Baphomet, and I'll explain it again. Elements are represented as above, so below is represented. The fact that it's part animal represents the earth, as well as it having both male and female human qualities, as well as pointing to moon phases, as to say that things go in cycles. And in my opinion, it's a hint, it's a pagan symbol hinting at the idea of reincarnation as well, as just a part of it. It's a symbol that's been studied a lot, and people have their different opinions on it. I'm just sort of mentioning my opinion. So now let's take the way this symbol has been used. In modern day times, and I'm sure you've all seen this, whether it's been on heavy metal records or whether it's been by modern Satanists, they use this symbol and they put it in an inverted or upside down pentacle or pentagram. Oftentimes, the five-pointed star pointing down has a goat's head drawn within it. Sometimes the names Samuel and Lilith are inside of this circle. Incubus and succubus, we mentioned earlier. Now, here's a statement to let you all know, by the way, that I am not a Satanist and that I am not a devil worshiper. But I want to clarify as to, if you're familiar with the LaVey Satanist, as to why I'm not a Satanist, for one of the many reasons. Again, I'm not being insulting to any. There may be a listener or two out there that actually are, so I'm just saying this from a scholarly point of view. It's a friendly debate. There are different types of Satanists, and I acknowledge this. I will simply state my personal position on my own path. And again, I'll sum up the Baphomet image, the image used by the LaVey Satanists, the five elements, as above, so below, a possible representation of reincarnation, a representative of life forces, the serpent and the staff, possible kundalini, representation of balance, male and female. To me, this looks like a very deep spiritual symbol. So I'm a bit confused when a well-known Church of Satan high priest, Anton LaVey's predecessor, or the person that came after LaVey, Peter Gilmore, says, and I quote, "We oppose any who make man spiritual rather than carnal." This statement and others that the LaVeyists make are, in my opinion, unbalanced and unnatural. It plays into a see it, touch it, then you know it's real ego atheism, which is basically what many modern Satanists are. They're atheists, and they'll tell you that they are. They'll tell you that they do not worship a deity. They will say, you know, hail Satan in their rituals, but they say it's drama and theater, basically. But so many of the quotes and doctrines that they say, like the one, and I will repeat it, quote, that we oppose any who refer to man as spiritual rather than carnal. It's just not a quote that vibrates with me at all. And they have many like that. Now, I will also acknowledge that there is other branches, there are other branches of theistic Satanism, or ones that do actually believe that they are worshiping a devil or Satan or Lucifer. Some are traditional, some are sort of patched together and eclectic. Some are polytheistic, some are claiming to actually worship the adversary in the Bible, the Hasatan or the, quote, Lucifer, unquote, of the Christian Bible, et cetera, et cetera. That could be a show for another day. So there are many branches of Satanism. So the branch so many people are familiar with are the LaVey Satanists, and Peter Gilmore, who's a high priest of their tradition, seems offended by the notion of having a spirit. So we'll take a breath. That is one aspect of modern Satan, modern devil worship and or atheistic use of what they call devil imagery, and here's where my debate comes in. I don't think Baphomet is the devil. I think looking at the goat representing the as above, so below, representing balance, male and female, representing healing and life force, representing possible reincarnation, representing moon phases, representing elements, including spirit. The Baphomet has 5 points in its star. The fifth element is spirit. I actually, if there was a LaVeyan Satanist online debating me right now, I would say, again, not in a disrespectful way, but in a scholarly way, Baphomet is not a satanic symbol, in my opinion. The fifth star, the fifth point in the star is spirit. Earth, air, fire, water, the point at the top is spirit. If the star is inverted, it has different meanings. You start to get into different male and female meanings, as well as degree meanings for different traditions. That I'm not going to go into today. So that would be my argument. And I may actually bring on a LaVey Satanist. I actually know one or two to argue with me that point and make them very mad that I'm telling them their symbol to me is not even satanic. But let us take a breath and move onward from there. Again, saying I view a Baphomet as basically a little more than sort of a yin and yang symbol. It's a symbol noting duality, balance, and elements and spirit. Yes, done in a way that can be frightening, because if you're raised Christian, I can completely understand. Goat imagery is kind of frightening to someone that's raised Christian. So if they see that head of the goat, it can look frightening. And I see somebody said, great song. Yes, that was Sixth Son by Woven Green. Okay, let's go onward. And I'm going to kind of make this the closing arguments here. We discussed history, biblical, pre-biblical, the idea of duality. Much of it did not exist in the Old Testament, but certainly came about, survived a little bit from the Zoroastrians, as well as came about later in the New Testament, and later by the official big churches themselves. Times of the Inquisition, I mentioned the Witch's Hammer, and pulled it back down again to the idea of the importance of having that adversary, that ultimate evil thing, that ultimate evil enemy, that again was barely mentioned in such a way in the First Testament. So, let's take a look at a duality that people think exists, and in a way it may. I'm just offering a unique perspective here. Let's look at Lucifer and Jesus. I personally think, myself, that there are powerful forces in the universe and that they can bring great harm. I as well have always been fascinated by ideas and philosophies which take a natural and balanced approach when observing the terrible or beautiful realities that can come about. When you open yourself up to understanding nature or to observing nature, or to understanding allegorical language, allegorical accounts. Things don't seem so cruel. They just sort of seem balanced. When you observe nature, it leads you to see just what is versus an eternal battle between good and evil that you're supposed to buy into. Again, I do believe in these in powerful forces. I believe in magic. I believe in deity, in spirit, and in a soul, and in reincarnation. I believe that nature can be cruel, but nothing in nature suffers for eternity. The predator kills its prey. The prey suffers for a little while, and then it dies. The pain is gone. And then it becomes part of the cycle and lives again in some form. I'll begin I'll go back to where I started. Isaiah 14:12. How art thou fallen from heaven, Lucifer, son of the morning, morning star? How art thou cut to the ground, which didst weaken the nations? Notice the term Lucifer. We discussed it a little bit earlier. It means light bearer. Morning star, light bringer. My source again is the Bible. The Latin lux or light is the root word of Lucifer. I will now quote Revelation 22:16. This is the last thing Jesus says to his disciples. I, Jesus, have sent my angel to give you this testimony for the churches. I am the root and the offspring of David. I am the bright morning star. Now, I do not wish to offend any of my Christian listeners. What did he just say, he being me, that Jesus and Lucifer may actually be the same person, the morning star, the great star of the morning. In the New Testament, Jesus is referred to often as the morning star. I have never seen a Bible of any of its translations of Revelations that does not have Jesus refer to himself as the morning star. And as we saw back in Isaiah 14:12, how art thou fallen from heaven, Lucifer, son of the morning, morning star? This similarity occurs in many different places in the Bible. I've mentioned the two most well-known ones. So let's take a look at the time period predating the Bible and during. In the time of the ancient pagan religions, it was considered almost bragging rights to be really good at astrological and astronomical accounts, to be great at reading the stars, of knowing your sun's seasons. So let's take a look at this. Let us look at the winter solstice, and perhaps this story begins to sound a little bit familiar for those that know the resurrection story in the Bible. For 3 days, the sun stays in the same position in the sky. The 21st, 22nd, 23rd, or 22nd, 23rd, 24th, the 3 days of the true winter solstice. The sun stays in the location for 3 days in the sky. This location, visible from Jerusalem, is near the constellation of the Southern Cross. During this time, the sun is crucified or held fast or fastened to a cross for 3 days. After the 3 days, the sun rises higher up in the sky. The days begin to become longer, and life returns to the earth. After the third day, it is spoken well in Corinthians 15:20. But Christ has indeed risen from the dead. The first fruits of these who have fallen asleep. For since by man came death, through man also comes resurrection of the dead. For even as in Adam all die, so also in Christ, one could say, our morning star returns. All shall be made alive. This is a truly beautiful story. An astrological account, or reading the skies, reading the solstices and the vernal equinox, a basic ancient respect of the phases of the sun, being stuck in the sky near the Southern Cross constellation for 3 days and is resurrected again. It truly is a beautiful and natural story. And it is a promise that Mother Earth has always kept. Thank you for listening today to Main Street Universe.